Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Hercules and the Space Gods. I am Hercules Invictus, and today my great honor is to have as a guest Joseph Foster. Now, Joseph is, among other things, facilitator for the Monmouth County Paranormal Special Interest Group, which is dedicated to the pursuit of the unexplained, and he hosts their Zoom show. And he's also frequently on MLTV's mainline MUFON show. And I've been in my professional life a vocational counselor and an employment specialist and a workforce developer. And his professional resume is one of the most impressive I've seen in my three decades plus of doing that. So without further ado, welcome, Joseph. How are you?
Hi, Hercules. Glad to be with you.
I'm glad, too. I was greatly honored to be on your show, and I had a great time. So according to Greek hospitality laws, you're here now, and I really want to get to know more about you, because every time I learn something about you, I'm incredibly impressed, more impressed than the time before. So, wow. Now... How did you get interested in the paranormal? Was this something that came to you early in life, or is this something that developed later on in your journey?
No, it actually came very early in my life. Actually, when I was probably around 2.5 years old.
Wow.
So it's a journey that's been kind of a very interesting one. Not planned. It just happened to be at the right place at the right time. And, here I am. Okay. No, when I said 2.5, I'm serious about that. I had a crib event that I remember, and that kind of started the whole thing off. So it was a journey.
It is
and
so
from there, of course.
This story. I was telling people the other day about a crib event that I had. Would you care to share your crib event, or...
Oh, sure. Basically, I was my folks were interim farmers. Neither of them came from a farming background, but after they got married, they decided that they wanted to become farmers, not understanding everything that goes into it. So they became, they started doing as journeymen. My father was kind of a journeyman, and we were living on a farm out in East Hampton at the time. I was born in Pennsylvania. My father was from Pennsylvania, and my mom was from Elizabeth, New Jersey. We were on a farm out in East Hampton, and my crib, it was a small cottage, a farm cottage that we lived in at the time. And my parents' room is where my crib was. And all I remember is one night, it was a very, very interesting thing. I was wide awake, and I was standing, leaning against the headboard of my crib, and I was wide awake, and I was looking catty corner towards where the base of the baseboard was against my parents' bed on my mother's side, and on top of the crib there was this very strange creature that was just staring at me, didn't do anything, didn't say anything. And the thought that was going through my mind was no fear, no curiosity. It was just we were staring at one another. And there was basically no emotion. But the whole event took maybe, I'm going to take a guess and say it was probably about 10 seconds. And then there was nothing. And I remember absolutely nothing. I remember, don't remember going to sleep. I don't remember waking up in the morning. And it was years later that I related that story to my parents, because I was able to explain exactly what the room looked like down to the smallest details. And my mom at the time said, yeah, that's exactly the way it was. And they were both in there, they're both sound asleep. But that was an event that I think had some bearing on the rest of my life going forward. Exactly what it was, I can't tell you. So but that kind of set the stage. From there on, it was I had my first UFO event a couple years later. We went to a drive-in theater out in Bridgehampton, which is out on Long Island. And I saw a zigzagging UFO disappear behind the screen. Very, very fast. It was a very bright white point of light, much brighter than any stars or anything like that. And it made 90-degree turns, three 90-degree turns, and then it disappeared behind the screen. So that was my first real UFO event. Now, then there would be others as I moved along. My next one took place probably right after Sputnik, probably about a year after Sputnik. We had a daylight sighting. My parents saw it, my sister saw it, and other people that lived on the farm saw it as well. So I can go in greater detail later on if you like on that, but that's basically it. And it's been all the way through. I had several events before I went in the service. When I went into the service during that four-year period, I had three more events, one of which was a formally reported event while on board ship. And then there was some other interesting things that took place after I got out of the service. So, like I said, it's been... I'm sorry?
That's okay. Were these also related to UFOs?
There was at least, after I got out of the service, there was at least two more UFO-related events. One of them was really interesting. It took place in March of 1997, March 13th to be exact. I was working on a government project out in the Mojave Desert, and I spent 6 weeks out in the Mojave Desert. And during that time, during the experimentation that was going on, they had the first of the Phoenix Lights, and that was taking place at the same time a very large exercise was going on. Not that they were directly related. But nobody's ever tied together that there was an advanced warfighting experiment at the same time a raft of UFO sightings in Phoenix was taking place. Well, again, is there a cause and effect? I'm going to say that there is a great possibility of that because it was pretty widespread activity going on in the Southwest. So.
Mm-hmm.
Another story. Okay.
So these
and then there was another one that took place as late as 2015.
Okay.
In 2015 was right here in Keyport, New Jersey. We had four orange spheres fly right over us as we were having dinner in Keyport. Right over the bay. They were flying in from the ocean and flying along the coastline of Raritan Bay. And then disappearing further inland. They were reported by other people as well. And that was four orange spheres.
Wow. So this phenomenon has followed you from the crib to your current life, and it sounds like that you've had a string of encounters that are not just, I think I saw a light in the sky. You had discs flying around and entities coming in speaking to you. So you had an entity looking at you in the crib. Did you ever have any other entity encounters?
There was one other. Well, I don't know how you describe whether it would be described as an entity, but it was a sphere of soft light, soft white neon light. And I had just come back from Vietnam, and it was in the middle of the winter. And I was living at my parents' house between shifts. I was still in the service, but I was able to, between shifts, stay at my parents' place. And it was in my bedroom, and it was I woke up around 3:05 in the morning exactly, because that was the time on my alarm clock. And what woke me up, my room was pitch black except for the dial face on the alarm clock. And there were heavy, dark drapes that were closed. There was a blizzard going on outside, and there was this, the sound of wind and everything. But all of a sudden, in the upper corner, where two walls and the ceiling came together by a closet, there was a soft white light about the size of a baseball, and it slowly grew in size until it was about the size of a basketball. And all of a sudden, the room was lighted like the day, the daylight, and the feeling was very, very hard to put into words, but it was one of the most pleasant feelings, sensations, peaceful, restful. You know, it was like there was a spell and you didn't want to break the spell. And I was wide awake. I mean, I was doing some weird shifts at the time, but I was wide awake. And that entire event only lasted maybe 10 or 15 seconds, but it was like a lifetime. I mean, and it was so profound that the sense was that my life had changed forever right at that moment. No reason why, no explanation of it. And I can't say it was religious, but if there was such a thing as a religious event, I would say that would have to be it, you know, because it was earth-changing, life-changing.
So how did it change your life? Because your solitary experiences eventually led to your connecting with other people who were also on similar quests. How did that come about?
It was kind of funny because the one takeaway that I had is that I didn't have to worry. Before I went to sleep that night, you know, I was worried about all things that young people are worried about at the time. Like I said, I had just come back from Vietnam. And, you know, there was a divergence from my friends that I had before I went in the service to the direction we were all heading in after I had come back. You know, we were on different paths, different levels. And so you had all the concerns. Well, what is my life going to be? What am I going to do next year? What am I going to do after I get out? You know, all these what ifs. And after that event, all the what ifs went away. I mean, they totally left. There was no longer any concern about it. And it was the fact was that I would just follow whatever my path was that I was on. I would just follow it and not worry about it. And that's the way I've been all my life from that point forward. So it was almost like the definition of childhood's end. But there was definitely some type of a guidance that was given, you know. How and when and who did it, I couldn't even begin to tell you. You know, I'm not an overly mystical type person, but it was definitely a mystical event that took place that I can't explain. But it's guided my life all the rest of the time. And everything that I did afterwards, everything. I ended up in places I should never have ended up. I didn't have the education for the positions that I had. I didn't have a plan. There was no plan in any of the direction that I was taking. It was all laid out. It was all laid out very gently for me. All I had to do was just put one foot in front of the other and keep moving forward, you know, and I would be taken to where I needed to be or where I was supposed to be. So, I know it sounds hokey, but that is the solemn truth.
I can certainly understand it. My life makes sense when I look back at it. But going forward, a lot of things just did not make sense at the time, and I couldn't tell you why what I was doing was important, but it felt important. And now, looking back, those experiences are exactly what I need to do what I'm doing now. But at the time, that wasn't clear at all, so I can understand that. When did you start your group at the Monmouth Library, the Monmouth County Paranormal Special Interest Group?
Okay, I'm going to say it's probably been about I'm going to say about 3 years now. It started out, first of all, I learned a lot about libraries. I learned a lot about county libraries versus local municipal libraries. I initially was trying to set it up and have these things. I'm not making any money. That wasn't the purpose of it. It was just to have people getting together and sharing information, right? Sharing knowledge, sharing information. And, you know, it was very benign. I mean, I wasn't doing anything extraordinary. I didn't have weird things going on. It was just a discussion with the people that had similar interests, similar concerns. And the county library system was very bureaucratic and very judgmental. Because we used the term UFO, they really fought me tooth and nail to the point of forcing me out. And I'm a taxpayer. And all the people that were there, they were all nice people. There was no problems. There was no complaints. Nobody was doing anything wrong. But it became such a political thing for the county that I said, well, the last I can do with this is going to a municipal. So I went to the city of Long Branch and the library system there. And it turns out, I knew about the library system because my wife was the chairperson of it for a couple of years. So I went in there, and they were great. They were absolutely phenomenal. They upgraded all their facilities. And then, so I was very happy having a monthly meeting there. But then COVID happened, and everything got shut down, So after a year of fighting with the county, I went to the municipal group, and they were good, and I was perfectly happy staying in that arena. Now I'm ready. I have to go back because they're open again, at least for a while. And I wanted to continue having the library because face-to-face is so much better than, I think, than, doing it over the Internet or whatever. But I was going to do both. I was going to try to offer both. They had the Internet connectivity, and I could, set up the cameras and, do some of that stuff right at the library. So that's my next plan moving forward. But that's pretty much the way it was. And again, like I said, Jen Stein was instrumental in pushing me into doing this because she knew my interests, and she also knew that Monmouth County didn't really have a lot going on. New Jersey really didn't have a lot going on in this area. So it was something that was kind of needed. And when I got into it, I discovered that synchronicities and everything else like that, there was absolutely a phenomenal amount of information that's buried away and just waiting to be discovered and brought out and shared. So, and that's pretty much what's keeping me interested in this.
And I found, because I do something very similar at the Creskill Public Library, did for years, since from 2014 till around the time the pandemic started. We would have a topic every month, angels, grays, reincarnation, dream work. We had a lot of UFO stuff, but mixed in were other things as well. We had cosmic spirituality. You name it, we had it there at one point or another. And for a lot of people, and I'd done the same thing in Pennsylvania as well when we lived there in the Poconos. A lot of people have experiences, but people in their lives mock them, or they're afraid that people in their lives will mock them. So I found that having these meetings encouraged people to come in, and then at some point they would feel comfortable in sharing their story. It might take a few meetings, but then they would share a story and become part of the dialogue when they saw that they weren't alone in experiencing what they were experiencing. So that became like the primary function of it, to provide a safe space for people who had experiences that they can't explain. And it eventually grew, and I was getting like local X-Files, historians would give me information about things that happen that are, freaky or unexplainable or fit into one of the categories that I covered. And again, the pandemic put a stop to that, but I'm looking forward to it starting again because it's very exciting and you meet awesome people.
Absolutely. Total agreement with you, Hercules. Now, it's funny, part of what I discovered, once you get over the point of worrying about what people are going to say about you. Now, when you're when you're working, sometimes credibility, it works against you. Especially if you're on you're on some type of a career track, and if you say the wrong thing, there's always that risk of having it held against you. But once I got beyond that, it became very fulfilling, especially talking with people And once they saw that you didn't have a problem, they tend to open up when they find that it's not a judgmental environment that they're opening up in. And I think that's what we wanted to foster in the first place, is that, and I'm not going to call it safe place because that's, that terminology is so bastardized these days, but it was just an area that if you wanted to share something without worrying about somebody throwing stones at you, it was definitely the opportunity. The funny thing about the UFO events in my life, the one when I lived in Colts Neck, it was on a farm, and again, my parents are on the farm, and our house was about 200 or 300 yards away from what we call the Navy Road, and the Navy Road links an ammunition depot in Colts Neck, Naval Ammunition Depot, with its pier facilities about 13 miles away on the Raritan Bay by Sandy Hook. And so one summer night, we're sitting out there after work, and it was like July or August. I can't remember which month exactly. But it was a beautiful evening, and it was right after sunset. So it was dusk. It was nice and clear. And all of a sudden, we saw this daylight sphere a couple hundred yards away from us. And it was just lazily flying from the bay area going towards the storage facilities. And it had these disjointed red and white flashing lights all around it, small lights. So we knew that was something very unique. Now, at the time, that would have been sixth grade. And my father was sitting on the front porch with my mom, and I was just lounging on the grass, and just enjoying the summer evening. And my sister was outside playing on the lawn as well. And my dad jumps up, and he runs into the house, and he tries calling Fort Monmouth, which is about 2 miles away from where we lived. And he couldn't get through the switchboard. He wanted to report the sighting, and he never got through. And interestingly, nothing ever showed up in the newspaper. Nobody ever reported it. Now, this was 1958, okay? This was July, August 1958. Now, when I talk about the synchronicity, the thing that kind of keeps me going is discovering synchronicities years later, events that are tied together somehow. Mm-hmm. I'm not exactly sure how, but somehow. And one of those events was I don't know if you're familiar with Nike Ajax and Nike Hercules missiles. They were an Army anti-aircraft missile system. The Ajax was a conventional warhead. Well, they had these batteries all over protecting New York City. And one of these batteries was located adjacent to the Navy Road that we lived on, but about 4 or 5 miles away. Well, in 1958, May 22nd, 1958, the whole battery blew up. It was the worst accident in Nike history. Killed 10 men, 6 soldiers, and 4 DOD civilians. Okay, so that happened in 1958. And didn't think anything more of it. Our windows rattled when it exploded. My wife, who would become my wife, her grandfather was the deputy police chief in the town where the explosion took place. And so, but this is all down the road. Nothing has been tied together. Now it turns out that years later, I was talking to a gentleman that worked at Fort Monmouth, and we were founding an arts council in Long Branch, the city of Long Branch. And somehow we started talking, and I brought up the subject, the UFOs, and that sighting. Now, this is now 1995, and he said, oh, yeah. He said, now, he lived about 4 or 5 miles away, also close to the Navy Road, right on a river, right? And he said, yeah, I saw that thing. It landed in a swampy area behind my house, right?
Okay.
So there's a synchronicity right there, validation, somebody else saw it and all. Interestingly, the guy who saw that was D.W. Griffith's great-great-grandson. Okay. Can't make this stuff up.
No.
But it gets even stranger. Now, this is just the one event. Now let's move forward a couple more years. 2002, I go back and I bring my daughter. My daughter learned to swim in the swimming pool on the farm that I lived where we saw that UFO. The farm was owned by a gentleman that owned all the Miles shoe stores and the Tom McGann shoe stores, gentleman farmer. And he had a swimming pool, and that's where I basically learned to swim. That's where my daughter learned to swim years later. It's now part of the county park system. So, you know, in 2002, the summer of 2002, a crop circle shows up about 200 yards behind my house, where my house was. That same summer, my house was torn down.
Oh.
Again, you can't make this stuff up.
No.
So anyway, the picture was in the Asbury Park Press. They had an aerial photograph of it. And it was mowed. The guy that runs the Park Service had the farmer, because they leased the fields to a local farmer. He had them come in there and mow everything down so there was no trace of the crop circle, because he didn't want people running through there, you know, taking pictures or whatever. Well, anyway, I figured nobody investigated it either. Well, it turns out somebody did, and they found supposedly some evidence of, you know, activity from radiation, RF radiation or whatever. So that's 2002. So you have these events that are tied together. Now, about 3 or 4 years ago, I come across, now I'm volunteering out of a Nike site, one of the two remaining Nike sites in the world, out at Sandy Hook. And we restored it, and I learned all about Nike, the radars, the computers they use. We had a couple of missiles, you know, and I hung out with a bunch of old Nike guys. Now, Nike, of course, was involved with UFO activity, but I didn't know to what extent. And most of the people that worked on the nukes, we had 24 nuclear-armed Nike Hercules missiles out there at Sandy Hook until 1974. Well, 1958, remember the accident with a Nike Ajax battery in Middletown, close to the Navy Road, blew up. Okay, that blew up May 22nd, 1958. Well, it turns out there was another event that took place in May 1958 at another Nike Ajax site in Olney, Durwood, Maryland. Okay? A radar operator actually is the one who made the report. He's part of the Disclosure Project down in Washington. And he gave all the information about UFO. They had UFO events for 2 weeks over his site and an adjacent site in Gaithersburg. And at the end of that two-week period, one of these UFOs actually crashed outside the fence of his compound and took off again. It crash-landed and took off, but it dropped off some debris. And the debris apparently had some radioactivity, because the Air Force sent out a truck and they retrieved it, men in hazmat suits using long poles. This is according to the radar operator. Okay, this is now 1958. Wow. So now what happened was they took the stuff away in an Air Force truck or an Army truck, whatever, and then a couple hours later, an officer comes back and they debrief the entire contingent of soldiers that were at this site. And they told them it was an experimental helicopter, they didn't see anything, and they weren't to talk about it. And they all laughed because they knew it wasn't a helicopter, apparently. And so when he went public with this. So he continues with his story. And again, the synchronicity jumps up and bites you. And again, only because I was paying attention, only because I knew about Nikes, and I knew about how they operated, I also knew how the military operates, because I was in the military, And now, all of a sudden, there's another thing that shows up, synchronicity. That site was, all the Nike Ajax sites were decommissioned by 1961, I think. And they upgraded some of the sites, not all of them, to Nike Hercules. And Nike Hercules missiles were nukes. Well, they could also have conventional warheads, but all the ones out at Sandy Hook were nuclear. Okay, 24 of them. So this one site down there in Olney Durwood, turns out that it was decommissioned in 1966. It was turned over to a government agency and used for secure communications. Okay. All right, well, that's interesting. And it makes sense if it fit the mission. You know, why not use it? They already owned it, blah, blah, and all that. Well, it was a couple of years later, I found out that they actually looked at in the decontamination. They had to go through, in the 90s, they had to go through some type of a decontamination evaluation of the site. Now, thinking back to this gentleman who said that there was something that was nuclear or radioactive, and it was turned over and it was kept by the military. Every other base has been turned into, either plowed under or turned into, garages or something for, municipalities, but not that site. That site was kept governed. And then, just about a year or so ago, it was taken away or given up by the agency that was there and given to another secure agency. The Navy took it over. So, again, if you start stitching, I mean, Nick Curto, he's got the right tagline, connecting the dots.
Connecting the dots.
What it all boils down to is just paying attention and seeing the dots and then trying to connect them. And once you do that, you find it's very easy to connect these dots, at least anecdotally, you know. And it's more than just one event. I mean, I could have left my 1958 event go and say, well, that's it. It was 1958, saw a silver sphere. How many other people's sightings, which were probably much better, but if they went back and they followed up on it, if they were able to talk to people without fear, what would they might learn about their events? So that's the reason I think this is an exciting area to be in. And listening to people and talking with people and meeting people and just paying attention to history and then extrapolating and going forward and using it as a building block and just keep building off of it. The truth is out there, and eventually we will know it. So, I'm sorry, I can go on for hours about this.
No, this is great. I also believe that the truth is out there. What do you think of the recent efforts in disclosure?
I am of the mind that it's more disinformation than it is information. And the reason I say that, I mentioned that when I was in the service, I had three events. I had 20 months at sea duty. And during that 20-month period while on board my ship, I had three separate and distinct events, one of which took place during the Apollo 11 mission. And that's the one that ended up getting reported. We had three objects fly over my ship in July of 1969 while we're sitting in Ocean Station Victor, which is in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, halfway between Hawaii and Japan. And it was during the Apollo 11 mission. Now, we were where Ocean Station Victor was. It's several hundred miles to the north of where the Apollo 11 splashed down and was recovered. Now, we're out there, and I was just going on to my midwatch. This is my first sea duty, my first tour at sea. And I was going on to the midwatch with the rest of my deck force watch standards. There were four of us, and that means we had four people we were going to relieve at midnight, and then there was the quartermasters and the ODs, and you had the captain on the bridge. There were a total of 14 of us on the bridge, and combat information squawked us. They picked up, using their air search radar, they picked up three targets, closing on the ship coming out of the northeast, heading on a southwesterly course. But radar said there must be something wrong, or something to that effect, because they clocked them at 3,500 miles per hour.
Wow.
1969. And this is three individual targets in the middle of the ocean flying in tight formation, in a V formation. And so we all go running out. We knew the direction they were coming from. We knew the direction the ship was pointing at the time. We were just dead in the water. And we were a navigation aid, so we weren't supposed to move. Just stay right on the station. And we looked towards the northeast. We were out on the starboard bridge wing, or the right bridge wing. And we're looking, and sure enough, we picked up three points of light on the horizon, flying towards the ship. They got to the ship, and as it flew over the ship, we all ran from the starboard bridge wing to the port bridge wing. And we watched them disappear on the other horizon. And so if you do some calculations, it took about 5 or 6 seconds for the objects to go from horizon to horizon. Now, we were at 44 feet. Yeah, they were moving. they were flying. And it was a beautiful night. There was no moon, but it was a perfectly clear summer night in the South Pacific. And the ocean was like a lake. It was just, and the Milky Way was from horizon to horizon. Just a beautiful night at sea. And so what happened was a couple of the officers on the bridge broke out their slide rules, and they did some computations, and they were able to corroborate that the speed was probably around 3,200 miles per hour, according to their assumptions, like we're 44 feet above sea level. And then you had to estimate the altitude of the objects, and that would give you your speed, your time distance, or whatever rate equation. So they were able to corroborate it. And what happened was the radio officer came up to the bridge. The captain, who was the senior captain in the Coast Guard, a master mariner, just a phenomenal person, he signed off on the papers that went back down to the radio shack, and they were transmitted. So that's it. You don't know what it was. I mean, if it was a sit rep or something like that, they didn't tell you about it. They didn't take your name. But we weren't debriefed either.
That's interesting.
And it was about a year later. Oh, here's and again, the synchronicities and stitching these things together. Now, I came back from that patrol, went to underway training, then we ended up in Vietnam. And then on my way back from Vietnam, we were sailing. We were about a day and a half, 2 days out of Guam, heading back to Honolulu. And we had another sighting, a daylight sighting, daylight sphere. But the thing, I got back to Pearl Harbor. Now I'm sent to school, a couple of Navy schools at Pearl Harbor and Ford Island. And I was there for about 3 months, 2.5, 3 months. And I made friends with a Navy yeoman. Basically, he was like a clerk, but he was a computer operator. And he worked at an operation on Ford Island that was called FICPAC, which was Fleet Intelligence Central Pacific. And it was part of the Office of Naval Intelligence. And we were playing tennis after work. We couldn't afford to go down to Waikiki. We were just enlisted men in Hawaii. So we played tennis after work. And I told him about the sightings that we had. And he started laughing at me. Right? So I figured, here it is. He's laughing because I'm a UFO nut, blah, 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 blah. But he said, no, that's not the reason he was laughing. He said, I'm laughing because we get thousands of those reports every year just from naval ships. Thousands of reports every year. Let that sink in, okay? Because what we're getting now as quote-unquote disclosure, they leak a couple of videos that have been out there since 2004.
They're
not even that new. I've seen similar videos both from the Peruvian Air Force, also from the Mexican Air Force, and also even from the DHS, they had objects flying into and out of the water around Puerto Rico, down in Puerto Rico. So all of a sudden, you know, this whole thing is being, you know, gets all this airplay. But if you think about it, they're talking about a handful, 5 or 6 sightings, and that's it. Now, if they started releasing thousands of sightings every year, now I'm impressed. Now you're getting what I think is real disclosure. This is a guided tour of Disneyland, I think. So, okay, but that's just me. I'm not saying this stuff doesn't exist and isn't true. It is. I mean, you know, it doesn't serve them any purpose of showing the video and saying, oh, by the way, it's nothing. You know, it is something. You know, people do see it. You know, sailors have seen things at sea probably since the beginning of time.
Yes.
You know, there's nothing new under
the sun. The stories survive, yes. The stories survive. And why do you think this partial disclosure? I think that folks have been conditioned to accept the possibility of life on other planets or life in other dimensions. Like, look at the Marvel movies now and the DC movies that are based on comic book properties. They're all multiverse. You know, there are countless realities and they blend into each other. And we've had Star Wars and Star Trek and all sorts of other movies for decades now. So I'm wondering, what is it we need to be protected from?
No, you're spot on. I think, I think there's two aspects to this. I think one aspect is that we are being conditioned. The other aspect is, I think the conditioning is trying to keep us so that we don't gain too much knowledge or don't seek too, you know, with too much gusto, because we may not like what we find. And I think there is a distinct possibility that, number one, I mean, I give this talk when I give the tours at the Diana site, I talk about, you know, we have literally billions of galaxies now, not millions, billions of galaxies.
Billions, yes.
Billions of galaxies. And our galaxy is a small galaxy, and we've got billions and billions of stars. Probably 100 billion stars just in our galaxy. So if you extrapolate, and especially now we also have 3,000 or 4,000 exoplanets that they've discovered. Okay, and they said they're looking at densities, and now the scientists are saying, well, we think that it's a probability that every star has at least one planet. Okay. So just multiply that out. Now, we have 8 planets in our, maybe 9, because there's something out there that we're not sure about, and it may be closing on us. Okay. So if we have 8 or 9 in our little solar system, there's a lot of other solar systems out there that have multiple planets as well. There's one 4 light years away from us that has, I think, 5 or 6 exoplanets. So, you know, we're looking at some incredibly large numbers, and the laws of probabilities. And now, some people don't like to use probability as the rationale that there is life out there, but there is. I mean, there has to be.
There has to be.
Yeah, exactly. And there's other things as well. I mean, I think, and it depends on what day of the week it is and who you talk to. There's like 57 different varieties that are visiting Earth. Okay? I think 57 is the number, because I remember Heinz 57. And I'm trying to think of who wrote the book about and documented the various alien species. And today I saw an email, and one person talking about, oh yeah, somebody built a base for aliens that eat humans.
Okay.
I said, okay. Well, everything's on the table, so, you know, everything's possible. But the thing is that, you know, I think the point is that if you have thousands of different or millions of different species or different planets, and they're not all carbon-based, they may be silicon-based, they may be something else, they may be multidimensional, they may be, you know, spirits, maybe the spheres, like if you go up to Wanaque Reservoir. Are you familiar with Wanaque Reservoir?
Wanaque, I've been there, yes. There were UFO sightings there a while back.
Well, it's been going on for 80 years. And it's not only UFOs, but they've had Bigfoot sightings there. They've had solid objects. They've also had, and I, again, synchronicity. I did some consulting work for AT&T back around 2000, okay? And because of that, I had access to the full AT&T email, list of all the email users on for AT&T. There's over 100,000 of them. Well, anyway, I was reading one of these, before they had blogs, they had chat rooms or whatever, and I was reading a report. It was a very interesting report, and it was about the Wanaque Reservoir, and it was about Team Orb. It was called Team Orb, and they were scientists that were studying the orbs, and now these are the small spherical balls of energy.
Yes.
And they're according to Team Orb, they were very, cognizant. They were intelligent. They would communicate with you. They had capabilities. But they either liked you or they didn't. And apparently, because energy was involved, the Army got involved. And the Army went up there. And I was thinking it had to be come from Fort Monmouth because of the Electronics Command.
Uh-huh.
But the Army showed up. And they set up all these sensors trying to get a read on what the energy was that was being, being used. So they set these sensors up, and overnight they left, and they came back the next morning. Every one of the sensors were burnt to a cinder. Burnt to a cinder. And so I'm reading, and the people that were writing the blog, it was kind of like a newspaper type thing. And they were interviewing people. A couple of the people's names I recognized. Well, there was one guy that was really of interest to me because they interviewed him, and he turns out he was a director of AT&T. And I think he was in marketing. And they asked him, would you be interested in whatever the technology is that is being exhibited at the Wanaque Reservoir? I can send you the I saved the sheet. Fascinating sheet. So anyway, uh-huh. I'm sitting there, and I had the guy's name. I said, well, that's interesting. I can check. And I checked, and sure enough, he was in the directory, and he was who he said he was. So that kind of added some validity to the whole story. And the story gets even better because there was a team Orb. Apparently, there were a lot of people that were studying these things, and they had a conference out in, I think, Denver, Colorado that year. And they actually brought a couple of the orbs along with them, supposedly. And, they were interacting with the people. They were being friendly. And as long as it wasn't the Army trying to figure out what they were so that they can either control them or whatever. But it's the synchronicity of, finding a name in a directory to be able to get validation of some of what you're looking at. And I find that absolutely fascinating. And that, everything is so two-dimensional. I mean, everything that we're shown is almost a joke because it's two-dimensional. It's not three-dimensional. It doesn't have texture to it, It's just, blah, they lay something out there for you. You read it in the paper, you hear it on TV or whatever. Two-dimensional. So, anyway, that's just an
observation. You mentioned the orb. And there was a theory a few years back. I have the books somewhere in a box. But the theory was that UFOs are alive. They're living energy. You mentioned the small spheres and that they're actually zooming in our sky very often. And the person in the book gave this technique that you did. It was something like with your eyes and looking at something at an angle. I forget, again, exactly where. But I did the exercise. I love trying things.
Right.
Whatever happened, whether it was an optical illusion or whether my third eye opened, I can't tell you. But I do know that while I was doing that exercise, the sky was full of UFOs. And they were like zooming all over the place. Yeah, yeah. And they were kind of like plasma, you know, and they were silvery and other metallic type colors, and the sun was reflecting off of them. But I could see them as solidly as I could see anything else. So the orbs brought back memories of that.
Yeah, and you know something? The interesting thing about it is that they're not all the same size. I mean, even that sphere that I saw in my bedroom, you know, I would not be surprised at all if that wasn't just another one of these entities, you know, from wherever they come from, where they coexist with us, obviously, you know, and they must be way beyond us because otherwise, you know, we would have found them and harnessed them or something. But the thing is that, you know, if they are, another place you can see it, I like looking at real estate, you know, like Trulian, Zillow, and things like that. Various places around the country. Always interested in looking at them. Every once in a while, I come across a house, and there's certain criteria that I use. Like if it's a reasonably priced house, and it looks beyond reasonable, why? You know, what's wrong with it? Well, you can find out it's in a floodplain or something like that, right? Or if you look closely, you see a house and say, gee, that looks kind of bizarre. It's a nice house, but there's something strange about it. And all of a sudden you go through and you're looking at some of the rooms. All of a sudden in one of the rooms is four or five of these orbs captured on the by the camera. They're all digital cameras now, so it's easy to capture stuff like this.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you start looking at it. I actually found one house in Oklahoma. I remember this to this day. I'm looking at it, and I'm looking at the orb, and I said, geez, there's a face in that orb. You know, I wonder what that's all about. And what I did, I screen scraped the image, and then I put it into an ARC program or one of the, you know, digital photography programs, and I blew it up, and I cleaned it up. And sure enough, there was a human face. There was a man's face with a beard. I'm not making this up. I swear I'm not crazy.
No, spirit photography is very old. And, with the digital, it is, as you said, picking up more and more stuff.
Yeah. So, I mean, if it's an entity or if it's a ghost, what is a ghost? You know, I don't even think we know. You know, we have multi-dimensions. We have... You know, we have string theory, bubble theory, you know, physics on a daily basis. They're finding out new things on a daily basis. We're discovering new particles every day at the CERN. They keep hitting, you know, sending those things and, you know, having collisions. And every day they're finding new particles. They're up to like 57 particles now. We're in 2012.
Wow.
They discovered the 12th particle, which is the God's particle. Higgs boson.
I remember the God. I forget what it's called. Something Higgs particle, God particle.
Higgs boson. The Higgs boson particle. Now here's another interesting thing. I work a radio telescope here. Okay, that's my volunteer thing on Sunday afternoons. So we have a 60-foot dish, and it's a radio telescope. It was put online by Princeton University. Guy that's in charge of it is the head of the physics department for Princeton University, who also spends several days every month at the CERN, okay? And he's the one that designs the sensors that they use at the super collider. So his sensors are the ones that are picking up these new particles. And I even asked him about one of the particles. Just over the past 2 or 3 months, they've discovered two new particles.
Wow.
But it must even be more than that. I asked him about the one. I said, because I'm, do you know who Jack Sarfati is?
No.
Jack Sarfati is a theoretical physicist, and he's been doing government work for probably 50 years, on and off for 50 years. And he travels in a very interesting circle. There's a guy named Brian Josephson, who is a Nobel laureate. He's in the email chain. And they're always arguing, but he is the one that's very interested in metamaterials and also the propulsion systems for the Tic Tac.
We're going
to
have
a lot of work in that area.
We're going to have to leave this on a to be continued, and I definitely want you back very soon. We only have a few minutes left, and I'd like you to share your contact information.
Oh, sure. Okay. My email address is joseph.foster, F-O-S-T-E-R, at Millennium, MillenniumOSS.com. OscarSamSam.com. Anybody wants to send me an email, I will respond to it, and I would love to hear from people.
And how can people hook into the Monmouth County Paranormal Special Interest Group or its Zoom meeting?
Okay, send me an email. I'll put you on the contact list, and I send out the information every month that has the Zoom bridge, and I send out with a flyer, and everybody is welcome. The more the merrier.
If you put me on that list, I'll share it on Facebook.
I definitely will. I'll shoot it to you, and and also I have a website, and it is www.millenniumoss.com. If you go out there, you'll see an archive. You'll see your show out there, and everybody's welcome, and send me email.
I'm looking forward to continuing, and I'm very excited about this new adventure. And I'll give you another synchronicity. I don't know what this means yet, but my name, Hercules, has been popping up in the podcast conversations where the Hercules reference has nothing to do with me. And also Nike, or Nike, as it's called. She's the goddess of victory, and she's often associated with Athena. And my last name, Invictus, in Greek, it's Nikitis, which is means victor. And on the internet, if you look at temples of Hercules Invictus, sometimes they're called temples of Hercules Victor. So that's been popping up in conversations, both on the podcast and off the podcast. So the universe has my attention. I don't know what it's trying to tell me yet, but thank you for the synchronicity. It moves quite along. Any last words you'd like to
Great synchronicity.
Thank you.
I was just going to say keep your heads up and keep your minds open. Okay.
Wise advice. Thank you so very much, Joe. This was an awesome interview. You're doing awesome things. And, again, I look forward to continuing on this adventure. I'm greatly honored that you're here.
And I'm greatly honored to be on your show. Thank you. Hercules, it's a pleasure.
Same here. And thanks to everybody who tuned in, whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, you dialed a number, or you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. And we're going to close with Virginia Ackley's If You Can Dream.
If you can dream, if you can fly, then your heart can touch the sky, but only if you can dream. If love is true and love is real, pain and sorrow soon will heal, but only